I'm going to start now. I'll speak for about 30 minutes, and then I'd like us to see a brief clip, and then I will conclude the lecture. Okay. So today's lecture builds on the discussion from last week, where I was talking about the question of representation with specific reference to the work of Gayatri Spivak. Today we look at the writings and thought of the literary critic Edward Said, whose writings lend a particular geopolitical perspective or geopolitical location to the question of representation. So in a way, one could think of this as an extension or a deepening of the questions raised last week. The issue of who represents whom and has the power to do so is tied up in Said's work with the issue of where the subjects and objects of representation are located. Okay? So in a sense, both Said and Spivak are interested in the question of representation as one of power, right? Who has the power to represent whom? Who are the subjects and who are the objects of representation? For Said, the history and the question of where those subjects and objects are located is of great importance, tremendous importance. The extract that you've read in the anthology for this week is from Said's groundbreaking work, Orientalism, published in 1978. The extract opens with the elaboration of what Said calls textual attitude. And that's the first thing I want to sort of just briefly explain, what Said means by textual attitude. For Said, this attitude derives from the fact that it is mostly texts. And I think texts here could be considered in a broad sense. Literary texts, visual texts, canonical and classical texts, but also popular culture, right, that is all around us and surrounds us. That it is mostly through these texts that we have an informed view of the world. That it is these texts that float around us and in which we float that inform our view of the world, especially of a world that we don't have first-hand knowledge of, right? So while we might be specifically located, in the Midlands, in Warwick, we are very much in the context in which there's a constant swirling of texts, of images, of sound bites, of places around the world, places that we don't yet have first-hand knowledge of or will never have that. Now, for Said, the power of texts lies in their implicit claims of authoritative knowledge and expertise. Okay? So what Said is saying is that the reason why these texts are powerful, because they implicitly or sometimes even explicitly make claims of authority, of knowledge, and of expertise. By virtue of this authority, they create not only knowledge, the knowledge that we have of the world, but come to constitute our reality. Okay, so these are not just textual things. They actually become our reality, part of our reality. And they constitute our reality through their power of description. Right? So texts about different parts of the world describe those parts of the world and in a sense conjure those different parts of the world for us. The texts become our reality. In this, Said is drawing from the work of the French philosopher Michel Foucault, F-O-U-C-A-U-L-T. Okay? Michel Foucault and his theory of discourse. And the whole concept of discourse is quite central to Said's theory and his thinking about Orientalism. Okay? Now, of course, this is a very complex theory, and we are not really getting into it. We don't have time or the opportunity to do so. But very briefly, we can define discourse as a set of linguistic, visual, and other signifiers that come to constitute or participate in the construction of material reality. And I will repeat this a couple of times because these are complicated ideas, right? So a discourse consists of a set of linguistic, visual, and other signifiers, right? Signs. And texts are part of discourses, right? Film, television, these are all visual, literary, textual, linguistic signifiers that come to constitute our reality, right? And they participate in the construction of our reality, and this reality which is also material reality. Okay, and I'll give an example if this is sounding very abstract. For instance, if we take Said's argument about the power of discourse or the functioning of discourse, we can look at the example of an ongoing global crisis, such as the war in Afghanistan, or as some people might say, the war on Afghanistan, right? Now, there are images and descriptions of people in Afghanistan, right, that are all over the place, whether you look at magazines, you look at television, journalism, scholarly books, academic books, political speeches, in all kinds of places, right, there is what can be considered to be the discourse on Afghanistan, right? And if one was to make some generalizations about this discourse on Afghanistan that consists of images and descriptions, one could come to the conclusion that in these images, in these discourses, the people of Afghanistan are depicted as either terrorists, right, sympathizers of the Taliban, or as hapless victims of terrorism, right, victims who are then going to be rescued by the military force of the First World, of Europe and North America. Now, if we take Said's argument, one could argue that this discourse, right, this set of linguistic and visual signifiers exerts power in that it helps create the material conditions of war and invasion. Okay, so what Said, drawing from Foucault, is arguing is that language and discourse have exercise material power, right? So it's not that we, you know, by creating images of Afghani people as terrorists, that we are doing actual violence to them, but by creating these images, by circulating them, by authorizing them, right, we can create the conditions whereby the invasion of Afghanistan can seem natural, can seem legitimate, right? Can gain our consensus. And that, for Said, is the power of discourse, right? To create, to have an effect on material reality. Now, one of Said's major contributions in Orientalism has, of course, been his elaboration of Orientalism as a discourse. Said defines Orientalism in two related ways. And again, I'll go over this as slowly as I can. In the first definition, Orientalism is a system of representation of the East or the Orient. Okay? So it comprises of a system, a methodology, an apparatus, a way of describing, of representing the Orient or the East. Okay? And the second related definition of Orientalism is a repertoire of images and attitudes and ways of seeing the Orient. Okay? So both are connected in a way. One is a system of representation, the other is a repertoire of representations, a repertoire of images that describe the Orient for us. Said located recurrent stereotypes within Orientalist writing in the West, or Orientalism as a discourse, but also through close deconstructive readings, Said located contradictions in that representation. Okay? And in his scholarly work, Orientalism, he locates the contradictions in the representation of the Orient that makes the Orient both attractive and repulsive at the same time. Okay? And as you know, this is sort of a running idea in the Buddha of Suburbia, right? The continuing power of the discourse of Orientalism, right? Which is both attractive, it's the other of the degradation of the modern West, but also repulsive because it is strange and barbaric and utterly different. For Said, Orientalism's major features have been, and in the book and in this piece, he lists quite a few of them, an irreconcilable difference between East and West. Okay, so one of the things that Orientalist discourse keeps harping on about is that the East and the West are completely different, right? You can hark back to Kipling's famous lines, right? The twain shall never meet, right? East and West are, you know, completely different entities, and there is no common ground. But we can see how powerful this discourse has been, right? All, you know, from the Orientalists and Rudyard Kipling's writings, all the way to more recently Samuel Huntington, the very influential American political scientist and political philosopher who has written on the myth, Said calls it a myth, the clash of civilizations, right? Samuel Huntington and other right-wing Americans see the current war on terror, right, as the latest manifestation of the war of civilizations, the clash of civilizations. It's a clash between a modern, progressive, liberal West that stands for human rights, for women's rights, versus, in this discourse, a barbaric, savage Orient, which is full of terrorists and people who do not value human life. I don't know if how politically conscious you were right after the attacks on the World Trade Center, but you can actually look at some of George Bush's speeches on the internet, where he precisely articulated this idea of the clash of civilizations. Right? This was a modern, forward-looking America which had been attacked by a barbaric Muslim world. So in this discourse, this idea of the absolute difference, the irreconcilability of the East and the West is always emphasized. And of course, Said's work has been to dismantle this idea of the clash of civilizations as a myth, right? Because of course, there are alternative readings of history which show that the East and West have always had relations, long relations of trade, of cultural exchange, etc., etc., and that, in fact, it is quite difficult to maintain the difference that the proponents of the clash of civilizations want us to maintain. Another element of Orientalist discourse, Said locates, as being that of an unchanging Orient. Right, an Orient that is static, that is free from history, in fact, that is outside history. The Orient as an unchanging essence that is primitive and barbaric, that has never come into history. And this, again, Said locates all the way back, you know, to the 17th and 18th century. You can find this in the work of the great Western philosophers, such as Immanuel Kant, Hegel, etc., who talk about history moving from the barbaric and savage East to a progressive and modern West, right? Hegel talks about the movement of the spirit, the dialectical movement of the spirit into modern Europe, into a modern West. Another aspect, and I'll say a bit more about this soon. Another aspect of this discourse of Orientalism is what Said calls the representation of, and this is a phrase from page 375, a living tableau of queerness. Right? So if you look at representations of the Orient or the East, you know, the typical images presented to us are those of, you know, voluptuous women, snake charmers, world of ease and languor, wine and song, on the one hand, but also despotism, sexual perversions, dangers of all kinds, women locked up in harems, etc., etc. Right? So, and these are interestingly not just images from the 17th and 18th centuries of the Orient, but I think if you look at popular cinema, if you look at Hollywood, it's interesting how often and how continuously these images of the East are recycled. Right? So we might think of them as quaint, but they are in fact very much part of our contemporary discourse as well. And I'm sure we can, you know, come up with numerous examples, whether we're thinking of Disney films or Hollywood films, James Bond films, you know, that show the barbaric Muslim, the barbaric Oriental, who is completely at odds, you know, with Western culture. Connected with this is the representation of the Orient as irrational, as lacking a sense of law, in fact, as being outside the realm of law. Okay. Said points out that this idea of the Orient as unchanging essence can be particularly seen in our contemporary discourse when you have sort of very learned journalists and scholars and academics who don't blink once to use phrases such as the Arab mind, right, or the Islamic worldview, all of these which are seen as the opposite of modern liberal Westerners. Okay? And in this, as I've pointed out, the West emerges as the realm of history, as the realm of change and dynamism, of discipline and modernity. Okay? So I've emphasized two, I guess, main points so far. One is what Said calls the textual attitude that informs our notions, our continuing notions of the Orient, even though most of us may not have ever visited it, visited the countries. And of course, the term Orient itself is an Orientalist term, right? Or we might not have first-hand knowledge. Nevertheless, we all possess a huge repertoire of images about the East or the non-West or the Orient. Okay? I want to sort of return to this idea of discourse and power, right? Which Said in his work talks about under the rubric of power knowledge, the relationship between power and knowledge. Okay? Said argues that Orientalism as discourse then helps create the conditions or participates in the domination of the Orient by the West. I gave you earlier the example of how, you know, the images of Afghanistan or Iraq that circulate all around us in many ways, consciously or subconsciously, legitimate the attack on Iraq and Afghanistan. And similarly, Said is arguing that Orientalist discourse helps create the conditions for the domination of the non-West, the East, the Orient. Okay? Said drew attention to the relationship between power and knowledge in his work, The Orientalism, and argued that in creating knowledge about the East, the West was more successful in dominating it. He gives the example, for instance, of Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in the late 18th century, in which Napoleon's armies were accompanied by anthropologists, statisticians, travel writers, painters, etc., etc. Okay, who were so making very clear that the aim of that invasion, that expedition, was not just military or economic, but also cultural domination. Pardon? Okay, should I stop? Okay. But to return to it, we can see again a similar thing to come back to a contemporary event, which is the war on Iraq. It was interesting to note that with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the demand for Arab speakers and Arab translators employed by the US state government increased. And so this idea, I think, continues to be a strong one, the idea that to conquer the enemy, you have to know it, okay? And that is precisely the kind of relationship that Said is interested in exploring, okay? Now, of course, one must say here that Said is not arguing for a pure instrumentalism, right? It's not... The relationship between power and knowledge is not so nakedly instrumentalist. Writers from Goethe to Flaubert to Byron, H. Rider Haggard, E.M. Foster, have been fascinated by the Orient, and painters such as Delacroix and others. Scholars in the fields of philology and comparative grammar devoted whole lifetimes studying Oriental languages, religions, and customs. Okay? And not all of this, we could say, could be directly related to the project of colonialism. Because what was created from the 18th century onwards, at least in Europe, was a general interest and fascination for the Orient. And what Said argues what this does is that it creates a field of vision. It creates a way of seeing and looking at the Orient, right? Which by itself may not be directly responsible for the violence of colonialism and other such projects, but creates a cultural milieu, a ground upon which most Europeans would have found these images about the Orient very familiar and very palatable. Of course, we have also seen historically that there is an easy slippage from scholarly discourse and imaginative literature, such as novels, poetry, drama, etc., to imperial institutions, right, to the colonial project that authorized, legitimized, and promoted Orientalism during the heydays of colonialism, leading up to the European occupation of the entire West Asian region. Okay? As Said writes, and this is from your page 376 in the anthology, the scope of Orientalism exactly matched the scope of empire. Okay? So this is it's a very crucial and difficult point to grasp, but nevertheless important to repeat, right? That knowledge about the Orient created the conditions, created ways of looking at the Orient that made subsequent colonization of the Orient seem normal and natural. Colonialism and Orientalism, thus, are seen by Said as complicit. Colonialism enabling the bringing in of manuscripts and other treasures from the East to Paris and London. If you ever visit the British Museum, for instance, you can and the British Library, you can see how that museum can be seen and read as a veritable archive of Britain as a global empire, right? So we think of museums as places which hold arts and artifacts, etc. But through Said's reading, we can see that, in fact, the very presence of those works of art, those artifacts, symbolize the world of empire that Britain had created. Thus, by extension, from Said's argument, we can see that most disciplines, most modern disciplines that we know and that we study at universities can be seen to have some kind of relationship with colonialism, in colonialism's desire to produce knowledge for power. Colonialism, thus, we can conclude from Said's arguments, was never exclusively about territorial and economic domination. That cultural control, right, through imaginative literature, through painting, through the arts, through scholarly production, was as integral a part of the colonial project as military occupation and territorial expansion. In this, the Orient or the East became the object of knowledge, silent and passive, and the West became the realm of the subject, of the knower and the representer. And here we can also connect it back to last week's discussion of Spivak, the gap between the representer and the subaltern who is represented, the subaltern who has no voice. Representation, thus, in both Spivak and Said, is ultimately about power in society. Said argues, who gets to represent whom and how and why and from where? Okay. I want to just take a brief break and have you look at a clip where Said is directly talking about his project in the book Imperialism, Orientalism. Sorry. Okay. So. Okay. This was just part one of this documentary. Actually, you can catch all the parts on YouTube. But I wanted to give you a sense of some of the images that Said references in his work, to give you a visual sense of those, and of course to hear from Said in his own words his project in writing Orientalism. Okay, I want to make just sort of two or maybe three brief points from now on. One stems from a question that one of my students asked in a seminar earlier this week when we were discussing Orientalism. It was Carl. I don't know whether he's here. But I thought that it was a very important question that he asked, and which was, and this was, you know, with reference to both Said's work, but also to the fascination with the East of many of the characters in The Buddha of Suburbia. And Carl asked the question whether it was necessarily racist to have a fascination with the Orient, you know, with the East. Would characters, you know, such as Eva and others that Qureshi writes about, are they necessarily racist because they are interested in Eastern culture and so on? And I thought that this was a very important question because it is an opportunity to think about why Said thinks of these representations as racist. For instance, he points out that the whole idea of the stereotype of the Orient, is based on historical, cultural, and racial generalizations. Okay, so that's the first critique that one could make when we are trying to think about whether a particular representation is racist or does it, you know, somewhat innocently represent a general interest. Also, in relation to this, other aspects of Orientalism that I have generally mentioned that Said identifies in Orientalist discourse, which is the emphasis on the past, right? On the classical period, not on the living character of the Orient. Okay, in the extract that you read for this week, Said talks about the interest of the Orientalists in a golden past, in a lost golden past, such as in India, for instance. The Orientalists had no interest in the history of contemporary India, in the history of 19th century India. What was of interest to them was sort of the ancient Aryan and Sanskritic civilization, which was actually no longer part of Indian reality in the 19th century. And so Orientalism, in a way, allowed the colonizers to argue that, yes, India had a great past, right? But that is now lost. And the current situation of India is a fallen state. Similarly, we see in the Orientalist heydays the emphasis on the unearthing of dead Oriental civilizations, Mesopotamia, Egypt, Syria, all of the information and the studies of civilizations, right, that we are fed actually goes back to the 18th and 19th century when the study of civilizations emerges as a discipline, right, as a form of study. Okay? And what it does from Said's perspective is that it privileges a dead past for the Orient. So yes, these representations, in my view, are racist in the way in which they deny the Orient any history. They deny the Orient a presence, except as a fall. Okay, and this one can see, again, in sort of contemporary representations and discussions. I think often Europeans and Americans who go with romantic views of spiritualism to India are often shocked by its rampant materialism, right? The fact that it is, you know, in every aspect of contemporary Indian life is caught up in a race, you know, for globalization, right? To become, India thinks of itself as a world superpower with a nuclear arsenal, right? But in the world, in the worldview of people like Eva and other people who romanticize the East and India, this reality somehow does not fit in. It is out of joint, okay? And the second reason why I would argue that these representations are racist is that the power of representation is asymmetrical, right? As Said points out in the chapter that you read, and in parts of this interview as well, that Egyptians did not have the same power to represent Europeans as Europeans had to represent Egyptians, right? And I think that similar sort of thing you see working out in the Buddha of Suburbia as well. Of course, the Indian characters also have their notions of what English people are like, right? But it is a distinctly asymmetrical cultural field within which those differences and those stereotypes operate. So that while non-Western people can also and do have stereotypical understandings of Westerners, they have much less power in the world, right? So again, we come back to the twinning of power and knowledge. Who has the power, okay, to form representations, to represent, and in what ways? Okay, I'd like to end with the whole question of crisis that Said addresses in his chapter. And that is the crisis which I've already alluded to. The crisis when the West confronts a disparity between texts and reality. Okay, and Said points out that from the mid-20th century onwards, colonized nations begin to gain political independence, right, from Western empires. And this independence is gained not through any charity by European powers, but through nationalist struggles of rebellion, revolt, and insurrection, right? So the nationalist movements of the mid-20th century against European colonialism, right, precisely show the opposite of the Orientalist stereotypes, right? That that Eastern cultures or colonized cultures are capable of action and of controlling their own destiny. These nationalist movements challenged notions of the Orient as passive and as people in the Orient as subject races. Okay? Said looks at a long history of anti-colonial and anti-racist rebellions, uprisings and movements that consistently challenged colonial rule and the racist frameworks it was based on. Okay? So in conclusion, the reason I want to conclude with this, that starting from the San Domingo Revolution of the late 18th century and the formation of Haiti as the first black republic all the way back in the 18th century that had freed itself from slavery, through the mid-20th century nationalist movements and struggles in India and Kenya, all the way to the last decade of the 20th century and the continuing struggles of the Palestinians, Through a study of this, Said creates a long alternative tradition of oppositional history, of history from below, the very idea of a subaltern history and of subaltern resistance. So this, in conclusion, to say that yes, while the apparatus of Orientalism, while the repertoire of Orientalism is powerful and has played a key role in the history of the modern world, that power has not remained unchallenged, right? I don't want you to leave this room, this lecture, or leave after having read Said, thinking of that this was unchallenged, that this was all-powerful, that this was all-hegemonic, right? That in spite of the power and weight of colonialism and of Orientalism, that these stereotypes, these images, these values have been consistently challenged. Of course, we don't get that in mainstream studies, in mainstream histories, right? In canonical literature. We perhaps have to do the work of looking elsewhere, okay? What Spivak talks about in terms of subaltern representation. We have what she calls doing one's homework, right? We are not going to be given that alternative history, you know, on a plate or in a neat lecture. That we have to do the homework of looking for those alternatives and looking for the challenges that have been made throughout to Orientalist discourse. Okay, so I'm going to end there for today.